Only a fool humbles himself when the world is so full of men eager to do that job for him. Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones podcast. Founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we decided it was time to rebrand and relaunch just in time for the game to do the same with its second edition. Tune in each week for your dose of strategy, discussion, jokes, and good old geek culture. Be sure to check www.whitebookpodcast.com for more content, generally in written form. Huge thanks go out to George R.R. Martin for creating this world, FFG for a great game, all of our contributors, and you, the listeners. Contact us on this site, facebook.com, as well as Twitter, or email contact@whitebookpodcast.com. This Creative Commons music is Townfish by Spoons. Okay, welcome back, dear listeners, to episode 250, a special treat this time around. We have an FFG presence with us again, this time, Mr. Michael Hurley, or Mike, as he's generally called, as I gather, or at least he hasn't complained about me calling him Mike.
I allow you to call me Mike, Will, but...
Oh, perfect.
But you're the only one.
Okay, remember that, Roy and Greg. You have to call him Michael.
Absolutely, Michael. I will make sure to call you that.
Thank you for having me on again. I love this podcast, and I've been looking forward to making a repeat appearance.
Yeah. So for anyone that is a little fuzzy on their memory or didn't catch it before, we had Mike on, let's see, just after the announcement of the second edition of the game, right?
That's right. Yeah. It was back in November of 2014.
Yeah. Wow. Seems crazy that it's been that that long ago now. It doesn't feel like it.
Well, it's I'm very happy with the way the launch of the second edition has turned out. I mean, it's surpassed all expectations of mine, and I think everybody at FFG, it's been really exciting to just watch the product finally roll out that we've been working on for so long, and to see people's reaction to it. It's been great.
Yeah, I've been really pumped about it myself. But to kind of maybe segue this into our first question, some of the listeners may not be terribly familiar with your role at FFG and kind of, I suppose, the impact of this launch and your perspective on that. So, you know, what is your role there with the company and your kind of connection to Game of Thrones and such?
Sure. So I am the Vice President of Product Development at FFG. I've been with the company for about 9 years. And when I first started in 2007, the Game of Thrones was still in the collectible format. The Five Kings edition had recently come out, which ended up being the last set for that game that was done in the collectible format. So that's when I was also introduced to the game for the first time. And I bought pretty heavily into it, right? Because I'd already been a fan of the books. And so I took to the game almost immediately and bought pretty heavily into the old sets, and then started working with Nate French on what would become the first core set for first edition. Wait,
okay, actually, follow up question here to that. So you bought heavily into that product. Did you realize when you bought heavily into it that the LCG transition was going to take place, or did you know, did you get stuck?
I got stuck along with pretty much everybody else. At the time, the company was much smaller, and there was not a lot of internal discussion about this switch from collectible to non-collectible. It was something that I think Christian basically just decided needed to happen. And so we went with it. But in hindsight, it ended up being a brilliant decision because it launched an entire product category for us that has done amazingly well.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. The LCG is just an amazing model.
Yeah. And I guess getting back to a little bit to what my role currently is. So because things have changed since the last 18 months, when I was last on the show, I was vice president of product development, but I was also at the time personally managing the LCG team. That is no longer the case. There's now a real LCG manager in place who reports directly to me. So at FFG, there are 5 development teams. Each team specializes in a different category product. So there's LCG, RPG, miniatures, and 2 board game teams. And each of those teams has a manager that reports to me. So that's kind of the hierarchy of how things go. But I love the LCG category. That is, I have a long history with that category from personally managing the team like I did for a couple of years. And so I remain pretty connected to those guys and that product line. And Game of Thrones in particular, I have been pretty intimately involved with the development of that game for many, many years.
Yeah, I think I remember when you were on before that you said you had been working pretty heavily with Nate on the tweaks and retooling for second edition. Remembering that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yep, it was. I mean, Nate was very much driving the design of the second edition, but for a long time, I was really the only person that he was working with and playing games with. And
so you were his sounding board, kind of?
Yeah, and you know, like critical eye. You know, I mean, I did design some cards too, but Nate did the vast majority of the actual card design. A lot of my contributions to the game were more broad. I think more on the vision side of things. When Nate and I spent a lot of time talking about what we both liked and disliked about the first edition of the game and where we wanted to see the game be taken. And so there was a lot of kind of push and pull and massaging of that vision over the course of many months before we arrived at what everybody knows as the core set for second edition.
So do you feel, you know, I realize this is a little bit like asking a parent who their favorite child is, which is an unfair question, but can you say that Game of Thrones is your favorite game?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, it's the game that I keep coming back to again and again. So, I mean, I always have multiple decks for Thrones just lying around my office. And I mean, I love our other games too, but there's something about Game of Thrones that I think is particularly special to me.
I mean, that begs the follow-up of what is your go-to deck?
Well, lately, I mean, I've tried just about everything, but lately I've been playing Tyrell Crossing, and which has been pretty fun. I've had more success with it in Melee. Just had a game a few weeks ago, a Melee game where it was me and Nate French and Caleb Grace, who some people might know as the lead developer on the Lord of the Rings LCG.
Yeah.
He also plays Game of Thrones. And then Caleb's brother, Josh Grace, is the senior marketing writer on the marketing side of things. And Josh has written many articles about all the LCGs, including Game of Thrones, over the years. So anyway, the four of us were playing a Melee game, and I was playing the Tyrell Crossing deck, and Nate was playing the Stark Sacrifice deck out of Wolves of the North. And Caleb, as always, was playing Greyjoy. I think that's the only house he ever plays. and I think Josh was playing Targaryen. And Nate went all in on a challenge, got up to 14 power, and was almost guaranteed to win Dominus because he had the Iron Throne in play. So, and nobody else was close, really, to winning. And so he was all knelt out at that point, and then he just kind of sat back and I think was not necessarily expecting to win at that moment, but was going to go for his actual win on the next plot phase. And he was just sitting back waiting to see what the three of us were going to do. And I had a Lady Sansa's Rose in my hand, and so I just hit Nate 3 times for 3 interposed challenges with some renown on the table and the rose, and just went from, I think, 6 power to 15 power. So that was pretty fun.
I love
it. It's a really good deck in Melee.
Yeah, it's done well for me.
So, Michael, one of the things you mentioned is that the game has exceeded the company's expectations, at least the 2.0 relaunch has. I was hoping maybe you could share with us what some of the initial expectations were from the company, as well as its objectives. And you, obviously, you've exceeded those expectations, but maybe, you know, giving us a little bit more insight into, you know, what you guys were hoping for and how you've exceeded those so far.
Sure. So the main reason that we did the second edition in the first place was that the first edition of the game had been going on for many years, and the card pool had grown to a very unwieldy size. It was around 2,000 cards, and we had, at the time, we didn't have any kind of rotation plan in place for any of the games, but we knew we had to do something for all the games, but especially Game of Thrones. And it was, you know, as we talked about it, we realized that any kind of rotation plan that we could come up with was not really going to do what we needed or what we thought the game really needed, which was basically just starting over with a hard reset of the entire card pool, streamlining some rules, and rebuilding everything from the ground up. That, I mean, I talked a lot about that 18 months ago, and so I encourage people to go back and listen to that episode if they want more details about what went behind the decision for second edition. But the main reason we did it was because we wanted the game to just keep going and thrive for another 10 years. And the hard reboot was really the only way that that was going to happen. And we knew that it was kind of a risky thing to do. We thought that there would be some backlash, but our hope was that the payoff was going to come from a whole bunch of new players getting into the game, because the second edition, you know, has been made more accessible, and it's just, you know, it's just easier to get into a game that that is just launching, that has a smaller card pool, as opposed to something that has like 6 years worth of product that people have to try to digest. So in that sense, yeah, it's been tremendously successful. The game is more accessible. We are getting lots of new players all the time, and we keep getting lots of good feedback and good reports from people saying how they've bought into the game. They've been introduced to the game in some way. They bought into it, and you know, and they're hooked, and I think they're going to be long-term players. And so, yes, design goal achieved.
Well, to follow up on that though, now that the Stark box is out, the first cycle is out, the core set has been out, you know, we're coming up on the, you know, first anniversary of its release at Gen Con, besides sort of bringing in new players, what other design goals that you and Nate sketched out for second edition do you think you've achieved sort of in the game's first year of life?
Well, we needed to add more granularity to the game with things like the cost curve. For example, in the first edition of the game, the gold curve was very flat. Everything cost basically between 1 and 5, but really between 1 and 4, because it was, most people just didn't run things that cost 5 gold. Or if they did, there would maybe be like one character in your deck that would cost 5. So that did not leave a lot of room. It meant that there was actually a huge difference between something that cost 2 gold versus something that cost 3 gold versus something that cost 4 gold. And so if we had a character that was costed at 3, increasing or decreasing that cost by even 1 gold was a huge change. And it meant basically that the card had to be redesigned. So it was very difficult to, over as the card pool grew and grew and grew, it became difficult to design cards that were fresh and interesting and impactful, that didn't feel like they were just kind of rehashing old ideas that were fighting for like this, all the same deck slots in people's decks and that sort of a thing. So expanding the gold curve out to something that is more like between 1 and 7 actually does quite a lot for us. And something that I don't think we maybe fully appreciated at the time we were working on the core set, but has very much come to light now with working on the first cycle and the deluxe boxes, is that we can now make 2 different versions of the same character at very different gold cost points that really truly feel different from each other. So like the perfect example, I think, is Catelyn Stark, where in first edition, we made Catelyn 4 times in first edition. We had 4 different versions of her, but she always cost 3 gold. She was, you know, she always had, you know, basically the same traits, the same strength, the same set of icons. It was just her ability that was different. But now in second edition, we have the forecast Caitlyn in the core set, and she's a very solid support character. She's got a good ability, good strength to cost ratio, but she's not really going to carry a game by herself. But then in Wolves of the North, we did a 7 gold cost version of Caitlyn, who I think can very much be the center point of an entire deck. And so now I think players have a really interesting choice where, you know, it's like, which version of Caitlyn are they going to go with? It's not really just different versions of something that's basically always going to fill the same slot in your deck. It's like, Corset Caitlyn is extremely different from Wolves of the North Caitlyn. And I think that's a good thing.
Well, you also made one big change with the Wolf's Box, which is the packaging, which has been, I think, one of the more controversial things about the Wolves of the North Box, which I think has been really well received. So why did you guys change from sort of the top sandwich, the original boxes, to these sort of newer boxes?
With the spiffy linen finish on this, we can't ignore that.
Yeah, they were really good for storing cards.
And adding in the chapter packs are different now as well. So.
So first of all, I am responsible for the change in the packaging. It was my idea to do away with the old deluxe box and switch over to the new style box, which is intended to be more disposable. So I guess I do personally disagree with the comment that the old deluxe boxes were good for storing cards. I personally don't think that they were particularly good for that, because the box is too shallow for the cards to stand up on their edge. They had to lay flat, and you can't really fit all that much, you know, in there. Like I don't, like my first edition Game of Thrones collection definitely grew to the point where there was no way I could fit like a single faction into one of those boxes. So it was not a good storage solution, in my opinion. And it was also, the boxes are kind of expensive, and we have tried, I have been an advocate for holding the line on the price of the product. And a lot of people at FFG feel this way. It's like, it's very important to us that we stick with the $30 price point for the deluxe boxes. And that has not changed over the years, but our costs have gone up. I mean, that's just the nature of the world. Shipping is more expensive. The cost of paper is more expensive. The cost of labor is more expensive than it was, you know, many years ago when we started first making these. And so one way to keep things viable in the long run without changing the price is by cutting back on things that I think are less important, which is like the nature of the box itself. So the new style of box that you see in Wolves of the North is much cheaper than the old box. It is intended to be a disposable box, but that still has a nice presence on a store shelf.
Or a game shelf at home. I like lining up all the different first edition house boxes. Still have those. So looking forward to doing that with second.
Yeah. So that's really why it was done. It's just, those boxes are just much cheaper to make. The same thing is said with the plastic clamshells, which I know have also been criticized. Rightly so, I think, because the old tuck boxes just looked nicer when they were, like, if a store couldn't display them on a peg, but instead put them on a shelf, especially if they were spine out. The old tuck boxes worked very well for that, because you could still read the name of the pack and everything. But the new clamshells did not have any kind of side spine to them, which we are going back now, and we are adding that back in. We've changed the design a little bit to make it so that it will have a side spine.
Is that for the second cycle?
Nice.
I've lost track as to like when people are actually going to see that on the customer side of things, but it is something that I don't know, people have, like stores have been asking us to do that. And so we've been going back through all the games and just, as the next cycle comes up for printing, we've been converting that over. So people will start seeing them show up soon, but we're kind of going one product line at a time. So I think Game of Thrones players will start seeing that pretty soon, and the other games will eventually get them as well. But the clamshell isn't just another cost savings. I think as some people have pointed out online, we use the same clamshell for all the games, so we can buy them in bulk. So we have a lot of leverage there to negotiate a really good price. And then the other rest of the cost of the packaging is just the paper insert that goes inside, which is much cheaper to produce than a fully glued together box. So again, holding the line on that $14.95 price point.
Well, a follow-up there, just I'm kind of curious thinking about that packaging rabbit hole. You know, in a theoretical sense, do you think it ever gets to the point where deluxe box packaging needs to convert to, say, a larger clamshell?
I hope not. I hope that's not the case. But, I mean, I am open to, as part of my job, is to be open to any kind of possibility that might make things more efficient or more cost effective for us. So I always have my eye on the next opportunity.
Well, what other process changes have been made for you guys on FFG's end between the first edition and second edition besides this packaging shift?
Well, the development process is largely unchanged. The main difference there really is just who is actively working on the game full time. So we have a new developer, Danny Schaefer, who joined the team last year. He was an assistant judge at last year's World Championship. So some people might have met him there, and he is going to be the head judge for Game of Thrones at Gen Con this year. And so Danny's great. He is the newest member of the LCG team, but he has a lot of passion about the game. He has really come a long way in a very short period of time. And Nate has been doing a really excellent job mentoring him. So Nate and Danny work together on a new set. And Nate also comes back in kind of at the end of a set and works closely with Danny. But Danny is very much, you know, in the driver's seat for the majority of the development and playtesting and refinement process for the Game of Thrones set, which is great because he brings a kind of a fresh perspective to things that that I think is healthy for the game.
Michael, in regards to the product releasing as part of the development and process cycle for each of the cards, do you see us having much of a delay between the cycle that we just finished, the Westeros cycle, and our upcoming new cycle? Is that something you can tell our listeners if they can be expecting, you know, the next chapter pack a month from the previous one? Are we going to have a break? I mean, is there anything you can tell us in terms of what we should be, you know, hoping for or expecting?
Well, yes. So the hope is that we have a release every single month and there is never a gap. I would say that has always been the vision for the LCG model, and that is always my hope that we achieve that. Our long-term customers, you know, will of course know that we have struggled to stick with that monthly release. We do have gaps from time to time. Many times it is because it's just a situation that is not entirely within our control. I mean, we cannot control how fast or slow a ship crosses the ocean, you know, or whether or not a customs official is going to decide to spend an extra amount of time in inspecting a certain container of ours. Those are certainly not the only reasons why delays happen, but those things, they do happen. One of the things that we've decided to do for Game of Thrones Second Edition to help with that, that's a kind of a subtle thing, is we have decided that when a deluxe box is ready to release, we'll just release it, even if it interrupts the release of a cycle. In first edition, I think many people will remember, if we had started a cycle, we would release all six packs, and then we would put out a deluxe box, and then we would start a new cycle. And one of the problems with that approach is that it made anticipating the release of a deluxe box very, very difficult. They were very unpredictable because they always came in between cycles. And so there was never a consistent time of year when deluxe boxes would come out. So for second edition, we've just decided, you know, we're going to put out one in the spring and one in the fall. And if if that, and so they will always occupy, they will always have their own release month. But if that means that we have like, say, like the first two packs of a cycle and then a deluxe box, and then we do the last four packs of a cycle, well, that's fine. That's just what we're going to do, because I think the being able to more accurately anticipate those deluxe boxes, I think will be, I think people will appreciate that, and it will be just better for the development of the card pool.
Well, kind of a follow up there. Now I'm curious if you're kind of establishing the deluxe boxes as kind of the anchor point for the LCG year. I assume we're going to have eight for each house, but that only gets us through about 4 years. Does that mean there's kind of inklings or rumblings of things continuing past that? Or is it just kind of a 4-year game plan for them?
Well, it's, I mean, I guess I will not say one way or the other on that.
that might have been a little too much to hope.
You know, but it's, you know, the having a deluxe box focus on a particular faction, I think is, it worked really well for us in first edition, because it creates the obvious second purchase for somebody just getting into the game. You know, it's like somebody is curious about the game. You know, it's easy for another player or store to say, well, buy the core set and then buy whatever deluxe box matches your favorite faction. And those two products will give that player a lot of great cards to work with, that where they'll be able to just have a lot of fun and they'll be able to make good competitive decks. And from there, then they can get into buying individual packs.
Well, speaking of deluxe boxes and people's favorite factions, a couple days before we recorded this, you guys announced the second deluxe box for second edition, focused on Lannister. Is there anything you can tell us about that deluxe box? And maybe what you guys learned about deluxe boxes from the Stark box that might have informed the Lannister box design or its release?
Well, it's so what I can tell you about Lions of Casterly Rock is essentially that it has basically the same makeup as the same template essentially as the Stark box. So most of the cards are going to be Lannister cards, but there are a significant number of neutral and non-loyal cards from other factions in the box. So even though Lions of Casterly Rock is the Lannister box, I think all players should definitely pick it up, because there is a lot of good stuff in there for all deck types and all factions, especially since, you know, of course, the non-loyal Lannister cards are also totally usable by any faction, as long as you're just doing bannering to House Lannister. And then I guess the other thing that we consciously did with that was a kind of a subtle difference between Lannister and the Stark box was that with the Lannister box, I think we just decided that, you know, we can just go ahead and include, you know, multiple expensive characters. So we have both Cersei and Tyrion, for example, that are in the 7 cost range. And whereas I'm pretty sure in the Stark box, there's only one 7 cost character. I have to go back and look now. I think we had a couple of 6s in there, but only one 7.
The army is 8.
The army is 8, yeah. So, I mean, we're not necessarily sticking strictly to like the same, you know, just like there has to be exactly 1 8 and only 1 7, but then 2 6s. That's going to change up a little bit. But I think as we were working on the Lannister box, I think that just kind of solidified in our own minds. It's just like, it's not really necessary to stick to any one kind of pattern with that. We can just do whatever works best for the characters that we're designing and for the faction itself. And I think as the announcement article has hopefully made it pretty clear, the Lannister box, you know, does address, you know, a couple of different deck types for Lannister. That, you know, there's kind of the Cersei centric intrigue challenge deck, and then setting up the Tyrion clansman deck, which I'm happy about, because that was a deck that I had a lot of fun playing in first edition, even though it wasn't super competitive. Thematically, I just really liked that deck. So I'm happy to see it returning.
Oh, absolutely. That was my favorite Lannister deck in first edition as well. And so I'm really, really excited to see what people are able to do with the Tyrion that you guys spoiled in the release article. I'm really excited to see that theme come back, which is a little bit present in the core set, but it's going to be really fun to be ambushing clansmen in and returning them a hand with Tyrion. And it just seems just a really fun way to play Lannister that's intuitive with some of its themes from the core set, but also somewhat different.
Yeah, it was, it kind of plays into the idea that, you know, the ambush is just kind of Lannister's thing. I mean, it's not a house specific keyword. I mean, technically any faction can get an ambush card, but we're kind of setting up Lannister as being like, you know, that's just kind of their thing. And so I think, you know, this Tyrion just is just another reinforcement to that idea.
Man, intrigue is where it's at. That's what I'm excited about. I don't know what you guys are talking about.
I am also excited about the intrigue challenge. I was a little bummed that that the small council chamber was not met with universal praise when it was reviewed on Card Game DB, but because I think that that card is better than what a lot of people are thinking. But I guess when they reviewed it, they didn't know about Cersei. So
yeah, I mean
that's true.
Yeah, everyone would have changed their opinion. I mean, just the synergies that Cersei creates are just so delicious.
I want to switch gears a little bit here, Michael. As you mentioned, you came on with FFG right around the time Throne switched from the CCG model to the LCG model. And I think we talked about it a little bit when we had you on a year and a half ago, but that was a very turbulent transition. The game lost a lot of players. And if you just compare 2008's Worlds, which was the last year that the World Championship was played underneath the CCG model, and then compared it to the 2009 Worlds, which was the first year with the LCG model, there was almost a dip in attendance. Okay, now I don't know what your sales numbers look like, but I imagine that, you know, there was something similar going on, you know, as you guys reestablished a new player base for the game. Well, we don't have that same scenario with 2.0. It seems like just the opposite has happened. You know, when you guys announced we were going to go to 1.0 to, you know, reboot the game to 2.0, there was a massive increase, you know, in interest in such a, you know, reboot. The Kingslayer tournament last year at Gen Con sold out in minutes. And I believe the attendance for that was 200 something. I don't remember the exact number, but it was extremely high. And we are seeing record-breaking attendance numbers all over the world, you know, in terms of store championships and regional championships. So from your perch within Fantasy Flight Games, what do you feel are, you know, the top two or three reasons that it has not gone the way it did when we switched from CCG to LCG, and instead has been a huge boon in my mind to, you know, the overall player base for the game?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, we just gave people a lot of warning this time around. When years ago when we switched from collectible to non-collectible, that change was rather sudden and caught a lot of people by surprise, especially since at the time the Five Kings edition was not that old. And so then to switch over to a non-collectible format, and then which in itself I don't think was where the real problem came from. I think the real problem came when the follow-up announcement was when we said, like, no, all the old collectible stuff is rotating out of competitive play, and it's only the non-collectible stuff from this point forward that's going to be legal. And so that was kind of the 1-2 punch without any kind of warning to the players that really upset a lot of people. And so we definitely learned some lessons from that, which is why we kind of went out of our way to tell people as far in advance as we could that the second edition was coming. I mean, we had a whole cycle for first edition that we hadn't even released yet at the time that we announced that second edition was coming. Or maybe we had announced that cycle, but we hadn't started. It hadn't all gone on sale yet. I guess I don't quite remember, but we definitely had unreleased product for first edition. That's for sure when we announced second edition, and so I think giving people that warning was definitely a big part of it. And then I think secondly, we have learned a lot about what makes a good core set, and we. So like the first edition core set in hindsight ended up not being a great product. It was a good learning experience for us, but in many ways it was kind of an example of what not to do in terms of an introductory product. So the second edition core set is very much, I think, designed with the idea of accessibility and bringing new players into the game in a way that where the game is easy to learn. Easy to access and just get people playing as quickly as possible, but also providing just enough depth to allow people to really take a nice deep dive and get a lot of deck building options out of that core set. So I think we hit a lot of good notes on the second edition core set product. And then I think with what has been happening on the organized play side of things, we've been trying over the years to branch that out and do more tournaments that are not championship tournaments or like regional level competitive tournaments, so like the Kingslayer tournament, for example, but also trying to recognize that there's a lot of players out there who love the game who. You know, like going to a high competition sort of tournament. That's just not their thing. But that doesn't mean that they're not interested in getting together with a big group of people and participating in an event. So our organized play team has been doing a lot of work lately to try to come up with some additional events that is going to cater to a broader audience without taking away any kind of attention from the competitive side of things. There's still going to be store championships, regionals, nationals, and world championships, just like before. So,
well, speaking of taking attention away, I'm kind of curious, you know, thinking about the influx of new players and that type of thing. I'm curious a little bit about the stability or sustainability of that for the LCG communities, not just Thrones, but, you know, is there a danger that kind of the upswell in one game as it launches or relaunches comes at the expense of some of FFG's other product lines?
That's something that we talk about, definitely. And I think you're basically asking, like, do the games cannibalize from each other?
Yeah. Right. Just to completely add on to Will's question, because, I mean, one of the big influx of new players that we got in New York are former Legend of the Five Ring players who are sort of waiting for FFG next year or the year after to relaunch their game. And yep. I wonder how much that can, like, we've sort of cannibalized what was that old one, how much when, you know, the next big LCG launch happens in 2017, 2018, how much that might cannibalize Thrones or Netrunner or what have you.
Sure. So, I mean, I think some cannibalization does happen. But I guess I prefer to see it as opportunities to keep those players engaged with FFG in general. I mean, everybody becomes ready for a new game from time to time. And when that happens, I want those players to choose an FFG game as opposed to going somewhere else. So it's not something that I really worry about that much, I guess. It's one of the reasons why we've worked hard to kind of broaden the definition of the LCG category and say, like, you know, LCG means more than just head-to-head competitive play. You know, it also can include a broader type of game. You know, something like Lord of the Rings, for example.
Does that also mean increased melee support? You know, it's not head-to-head.
Yeah, I mean, why not? I love the melee format. I can't speak specifically to what OP has planned, but I mean, it is a format that a lot of people love about Thrones. And I know for many people, it's their favorite way to play or their preferred way to play the game. So yeah, why not do
Michael,
more?
You said, you know, you don't worry about the games cannibalizing from each other. Maybe worry isn't the right word. You've established that Thrones is your favorite game. So do you actually like root, you know, like if you see sales figures for Thrones to like be the at the top of the LCG pyramid, so to speak?
No. I mean, yes, I see the sales figures, but I, you know, I love all my children equally well. So what I actually hope to see is that all the games grow to the point where they're all bigger than they are today. So if that happens, then I'm really happy.
Is there a danger, though? I mean, I understand that, you know, players staying within the FFG community is great for you guys. But, you know, as people who largely play one game from FFG, which I think the three of us here do, is there a danger of sort of say, you know, when the next great LCG comes, it can cannibalize too much from one LCG to another, in which it no longer makes sense for, say, LCG A for you guys to make it anymore because your players have shifted to LCG B or C or D?
Well, I think when that sort of thing happens, and it's inevitable that a game will just lose, you know, become less popular and eventually die out. But when that happens, I don't really foresee the main reason being because all the players shifted over, you know, like en masse to another game. I guess maybe that would happen, but I think it's more likely that, you know, that people just become lapsed card players in general, and they just kind of leave that category, because that is also something that I think does happen. I think people who are gamers tend to stay gamers for life, but I think just speaking from my own experience, I was not always a card player. For many years, I basically only played role-playing games because that's just what I was into. But these days, I rarely play a role-playing game because I just don't have time. It's much easier for me to find time to play a card game or two than it is to devote, you know, 4 to 5 hours to a role-playing session.
Okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and actually push us back into a completely new field, a whole new gear here. And rather than talking in some of these generalities and broad strokes, which fascinating as they are, I know listeners love when we have concrete information for them. And Mike brought a couple of doozies of concrete information with him for the episode this week. So why don't you tell us what you brought along?
Oh, you want me to read the cards?
Yeah.
Well,
the guest's privilege.
Well, how about this? So I will set it up. So I brought two Greyjoy cards from a forthcoming pack in the second cycle. They're both Greyjoy cards, and one of them is a character, and the other one is an event. But I would like to suggest, you know, that one of you guys, perhaps Greg, wants to lead us through the first one.
Which one do you want to do, Greg? The event or the character?
I'm going to do the character. So yeah, I'll get started. Thanks for bringing these, Mike, so we can share some spoilers a little early with our listeners. So the first one is going to be a new iteration of Balin Greyjoy. 7 costs. So again, you mentioned, Michael, you know, difference in cost points for some of our, you know, key characters. So 7 costs, military and power icons, 5 strength, ironborn king and lord trait, and he is loyal. Renown keyword with a little bit of text here, so bear with me. Balin Greyjoy does not kneel when declared as an attacker in a military challenge against opponent who does not control a king character. And then he also has an action, kneel a Greyjoy location to give each loyal character you control +1 until the end of the challenge, limit once per challenge. There's a little bit there to chew on.
So what's your first reaction, Greg?
The first reaction is, let me get this straight in my head, what he does. but I see that, you know, does not kneel when declared as an attacker in a military game. So basically, You want your opponent not to have a king. If they don't have a king, you're going to get two challenges out of Balin, assuming you're the first player. You're going to attack with him in military, maybe in power, get a couple renown on him. The funny thing is, as I was reading his action, I was still reading it in the context of the core set Balin. I'm sitting there thinking, oh, kneel a location, give him plus one. Oh, that's going to be great with his... No, wait, wrong Balin. but, you know, the fact that it gives that strength bump to all loyal characters is a little interesting. You know, depending on how many you can get out, you know, there you can attack with a pretty good bevy of pretty good bulk of strength there.
Well, and then it's any Greyjoy location can be used.
So yes, you could do it with even your zero cost reducers if you didn't use them for as reducers. So
yeah, slight rules clarification for any listener that got really excited by Mike drawing attention to any It's probably still worth noting you cannot use your opponent's Greyjoy locations. They still have to be yours.
Right. But he does give you
a rule of cost. Yeah.
He does give you an alternate use for like the Greyjoy cards that reward you for going first. If for some reason your opponent gives you, you know, makes you second. So, you know, you can now get an additional, you know, that raiding longship isn't useless now that you're second. You can now use it for plus one strength. And Balin doesn't have to be participating, if I'm reading this correct. So you could give it to a character that you're defending with to, you know, prevent someone from putting Balin to the sword, for example, or things like that, you know, and then push challenges with Balin. So he's a little bit more flexible, I guess, than the core set Balin, who is sort of does one thing really well. And this Balin sort of has a few other uses than that.
You know, it's kind of funny you mentioned the doing one thing. I'm noticing a bit of a theme in preview cards I've seen here recently with Cersei and the Barristan Selmy and the Lines of the Rock preview, and now this Balin with a lot of these recognizable characters getting a lot of, action advantage to steal the term from folks discussing the Lord of the Rings LCG, where they get to participate in or do multiple things a turn, which it, you know, is a good way to provide a lot of impact for those characters.
You know,
I think it also kind of calls it, you know, points out a slight difference in like design philosophy between a core set card and something that you would find in a pack, you know, in that we tried hard to make the cards in the core set really good cards that are going to have a long life in the card pool and be valid considerations without going crazy on the complexity. But there's still plenty of room for interesting complexity in the game. But this type of Balin is definitely not a core set Balin. For example, like this is something that you would definitely find in a cycle. So,
hey, listeners, you're going to notice a big break here. Apologies for that. Something went crazy with the recording software, and we wound up losing about the last 10 minutes of our discussion with Mike. So I apologize for that. We lost the second preview card, as well as some good discussion about the possibility of an upcoming FAQ or restricted list or the like. In the briefest of summaries, I'll say, you know, they have no current concrete plans, as I understood it, for something coming up soon. We're kind of all thankful that most of the rules issues have been pretty straightforward and answered by the very well detailed rules reference guide and the like. You know, but something later this year as an update is probably likely. So we'll see what happens. Errata is not something Mike's a fan of, and I know FFG in general is not, but hopefully a restricted list doesn't wind up having to be a thing. So we'll just kind of see how it goes. But aside from that, My co-host Patrick has been kind enough to jump on for a moment here, so we can still talk about our second preview card.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Well, do you want to read that once? You know, feel a little better for jumping in here at late notice on a Saturday?
Yeah, sounds good. All right. So the second preview card we have is Ours is the Old Way. It is a 4-cost Greyjoy event. It is non-loyal. And it is a challenges action. Until the end of the phase, either each Greyjoy character you control gains stealth, or each non-Greyjoy character loses stealth. Wow, that is an expensive event. That is the most expensive event we have ever seen in this game. By one, I think. Because Take the Black is 3, but Take the Black is loyal, so Fealty can reduce it.
Right, and Take the Black gives you like hard card advantage.
Yeah,
the deal, right?
Yeah,
this is more nebulous.
I think this card has basically got to be like, you play this and then you just win the game by getting unopposed challenges. I can't imagine that you could afford to spend your whole turn playing this card unless it was to win. Like, that is so huge. 4 gold, non-reducible. Oof.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. Like, gosh, I'm iffy about it in Joust, but like, I think I could see a lot of situations in Melee
where
this is the card that just ends the game for you. And even if someone happens to be sitting on a hand's judgment, like, who's sitting on their whole turn to pay 4 to cancel, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think you're right on there. If you can get this going in Melee, that could be huge. That could be a game-ending card. It's a pity that Rise of the Kraken only has 2 gold, so you're gonna need 2 resources with that, either Rose Roads or Tourney Grounds to be able to,
or Tyrion off on that, like, turn.
Or Tyrion,
this
pretty
much scream Tyrion as an almost necessity to play it.
Yeah, I guess if you're like Greyjoy, Banner of the Lion, or like, I guess Lannister, like false Banner of the Kraken, so you have mostly Greyjoy characters, this could potentially work there.
So I think maybe the most important question, okay, maybe not the most, but an important question, which option do you think you'll choose most often?
I think I gotta go with the your characters gain stealth, because it really depends on the board state for sure, but I often find when I'm playing Greyjoy that unless it's a mirror match or maybe my opponent has a Sirio, I'm not really looking at more than 2 or 3 stealths on their side of the table. And, you know, if it gets to that level and I maybe have like an Asha going, then maybe I would take all of their stealth so she can kind of work around them. You know, either way, I don't know. I mean, this is kind of getting away from that question specifically, but either way, I really don't know if it's going to have enough of an impact. Because if you give all your characters stealth, you're still not necessarily going to be getting unopposed if they have stealth. And if you take all of their stealth, then you also need stealth to get past their people, even though they don't have stealth anymore. So it's really kind of like a bit of a double-edged sword, I think. And if you can play 2 of them in the same turn, you probably win the game. But that's like 8 gold, so that's insane. What do you think, Will?
Gosh, between the two, I think I also lean towards giving all of your people stealth as opposed to making the opponent's character lose stealth. We'll see. I think it's probably going to depend, obviously, on board state, which one is more likely to generate the unopposed challenges, since, you know, maybe you only have 1 or 2 stealthy guys on your side anyway, and if you're removing stealth from, I don't know, their Sirio or whatever, now maybe they've still got a couple other people that could defend, and you're not generating the extra stealth to get around them.
I don't know from a strictly unopposed perspective in Joust, which is probably the better option. But as far as winning your challenges go, I think that giving all of your people stealth is going to lead to all of your challenges being won. They may not be unopposed, but you'll win.
Definitely. And I think you're right about it being a melee card. I just, like, the more I look at it, the more I just can't see myself putting this in a Joust deck. Like, the more cards come out, the more we kind of boil down decks and get them to just, like, the most efficient cards that you can play and what's going to help you win the quickest, at least for, you know, a Jamie player, primarily like myself. And I mean, this is a very Shaga card. Like, it is a big, flashy effect. And if you can get it to work and you can play it at the right time and you have the right plot and you're at the right power level, maybe it wins you the game, or maybe it stops a mirror match Greyjoy from winning the game. But even then, it only takes away stealth for non-Greyjoy characters, so it doesn't even help you if your opponent's Greyjoy. So I don't know. I can't see myself playing this and waiting for that opportunity, because if you're behind, a lot of the time this card is just going to be sitting in your hand and you're going to be wishing it was a character or a lower cost event.
A lot of times. Thinking about that cost, though, does lead me to one other thing that this high cost makes me wonder, and that is, will we start seeing more challenge phase, like, income generation? We've seen from the core set through the first cycle how incredibly potent Tyrion's challenge phase gold is. And people have kind of complained about that. I know Greg's really been down on it. So maybe the design team is going to, like, give a couple other houses some version of that capability. Like, I could see a really strong Nedley, like, kind of raiding aspect for Greyjoy somehow that would make this more playable and fit.
Well, I mean, we already have loot. So
you gotta win the unopposed first, though.
Hopefully that's not the best Greyjoy ever gets for challenge phase gold gain. But yeah, I mean, if they had something like Indoran's name or something to that effect that let them gain gold in some fashion, that would make this card a lot more playable.
I think warships to gain X gold or something.
Yeah, cool. something like that. I mean, I think at this point, you basically have to be playing Tyrion and or Turning Grounds to actually play this card.
I think you're totally right.
But I mean, I think it's definitely a card that if you're playing the new King Balon that you guys just discussed, I mean, not playing Corset Balon is a huge hit to winning those unopposed challenges. So if you are playing that new King Balon, maybe you're going to need something like this to help you get that, you know, big swing. But I think this card is, the ours is the old way, has a significantly worse effect than Corset Balon.
Yeah, it's, gosh, it's really different. I just kind of assume there's going to be a lot of more kind of King tech and support that's going to make that particular decision point harder for me, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's got to be, because, like, Corset Balon is just so good, and he just fits the theme of Greyjoy so well. And, like, everything that they have so far has been centered around winning those unopposed challenges, and he does that so effectively. And, you know, I mean, we don't have to get into King Balon, I'm sure you guys just talked about him, but his ability to participate in multiple challenges is good, but Core Balon has won games, many games, single-handedly, pretty much, so it's tough to give up.
I agree with that completely. Hey guys, this is Will. Just wanting to give a quick little shout out to replace Props and Slops this week. I want to say thank you so much to Mike Hurley for coming on to the show this week and chatting some more about some behind-the-scenes stuff with the game and letting us get that insight. Thanks, of course, to my fantastic co-hosts over the last several years. Thank you for helping us make it to 250 episodes. And most of all, thank you to each and every one of you, the listeners, for sticking with us or discovering us recently and enjoying the show. Thank you, and that closes another chapter of the White.